The Recovery Room is supported by a grant from the American College of Surgeons Foundation.
Making sense of modern medicine, this is The Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. On today's show, an obesity expert explains the origins of the epidemic and shares her vision of a health-conscious country. And a bioethicist concerns about the limitations of President Obama's groundbreaking hospital visitation rights memo. If you're looking for good news on the obesity front, there is some. Recent data suggests that the national obesity rate has plateaued. Unfortunately, it's plateaued at a really high level. 70% of us are overweight. The obesity rate is double what it was three decades ago. And our kids are three times more likely to be obese than they were in the 1970s. What happened? Did food change? Did the environment change? Did we change? And is there anything we can do about it? City and state governments have been contemplating sin taxes for soda and junk food. Weight loss surgery has become a popular alternative to treating obesity. And earlier this year, a White House Childhood Obesity Task Force released a report full of recommendations for changing the way we battle what many call a national crisis, if not a full-blown epidemic. Joining us now to talk about the country's obesity problem is Dr. Maria Collazo-Clavel. Dr. Collazo-Clavel is an associate professor of medicine in the Department of Internal Medicine at the Mayo Clinic Medical School in Rochester, Minnesota. Her specialties include the clinical study of obesity and its complications, as well as weight loss interventions. Dr. Collazo-Clavel, thanks for joining us today on The Recovery Room.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here with you.
Maria, let me ask you something. It's been called an epidemic, a crisis. You know, for you as an internist and an endocrinologist, what do you see as the real problem here?
Well, probably what we have noticed is that definitely diseases that we used to diagnose later in life, you know, type 2 diabetes and so on, that we typically diagnose in the 40s and 50s, we were certainly diagnosing people in their 20s and even young adolescents. And clearly our genetics have not changed, but what has changed is our lifestyles, the way we live our lives. We have food readily available. We're definitely less active. We have to seek out activity. So all these factors have certainly contributed to a gradual weight gain that has now truly started to impact our health.
So do you see the problem really as a crisis in the adolescent and childhood years? Is that where the issue is, and should that be where more of our emphasis is put?
Well, it's affecting all age groups, but certainly the sharpest rise in the rate of overweight and obesity is in our children and our adolescents and young adults. So it's an issue that we're going to be dealing for much longer. And actually hearing that the obesity rise, the prevalence has plateaued, is good news because it was rising at a very steep rate. So now the challenge is, how do we turn this around? How do we recruit younger people to lead healthier lives when they're still perhaps in an unhealthy environment, whether that's at home or at school or anywhere else in their neighborhood?
So the medical issues, I mean, you're an internist, mm-hmm. You're in a major medical center. If I have a problem with obesity, should I come to somebody like you, or is there somebody in the professional field that can really help me?
Well, definitely in our offices, we're not going to solve the obesity epidemic in our office setting because it extends way beyond that. But our role as physicians is to identify those individuals that are overweight, obese, or at risk of doing so or becoming so, and also discuss, you know, what are the health risks of excess weight, and also try to identify resources to help our patients manage their weight. For the longest time, the medical profession really wasn't involved and helping people manage their weight. We advise people lose weight, and individuals went out and found out a way to do that. And as a result, there's multi-million dollar industries out there trying to help people lose weight. The difficulties is that it's not a quick fix. For people to be successful in the short and the long term, they do have to make some longstanding changes to their eating and activity habits. And in our current society, that is hard. So people need ongoing support, and I see the physician's role as providing support, guidance, and good information based on medical literature.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the term quick fix. You know, again, from a surgical standpoint, a lot of people feel, well, maybe this whole idea of obesity surgery is really the wrong way to go. Maybe it's just a quick fix. Really doesn't take care of the issue. Well, what is your take on surgery for obesity?
Well, obesity surgery definitely has a role, and really what pushes us that way is health. At least that's the principles we follow at Mayo. You know, we consider these more aggressive interventions when people's health is at risk, when the amount of weight they need to lose is likely to be achieved with a surgery and not with medical weight loss. But, you know, it's people still have to put in a lot of effort to maintain that weight loss after weight loss surgery. So having a weight loss surgery doesn't mean I no longer have to worry about my eating habits or my activity. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, these surgeries are often meant to help people adhere to healthier dietary habits. And the physical activity aspect of things, we're hoping that as people lose weight, they have better mobility and they're better able to stay physically active. But they still face many other challenges to adhering to lifestyle changes.
One of the issues that keeps coming up, are we dealing with a genetic disease? Are we dealing with something that's acquired? You know, in the early 70s, for instance, the childhood obesity rate was about 5%. And over the last few years, it's risen to 30%. Why have we seen this exponential rise in obesity, especially in children and adolescents?
Well, there's definitely a genetic component. The issue is that the genes that probably helped people survive hundreds of years ago by allowing them to conserve energy in the current environment where food is readily available and we don't need to be as physically active, those individuals have suffered most of the disadvantages. But clearly what has changed the most the past 20, 30 years is our environment, are our eating habits and our activity habits. We have a lot more high-calorie food readily available and we're less physically active. And there's actually have been studies looking at activities that are not formal exercise, leisure-like activities. And if you look at the percentage of time that individuals spent in leisure time activities that were not considered exercise, this might have been walking, this might have been biking, this might have been just joining a game that was around the neighborhood, it has decreased significantly amongst all age groups. Not walking to school, I mean, we've heard all this before, but what we do day in and day out burns a lot of calories, and our lifestyle today is a lot more sedentary than it was in the past. I would tell you the vast majority of people, when they gain weight, is often related to a change in their activity, not so much an obvious change in their eating habits. The good thing about that is that we actually can make changes. You know, we can't change our genes in the next 5-10 years, although, you know, who knows, but we can make changes in our environment and our choices every day. There's not always easy, but it can be done. And that's kind of the focus of successful weight management for individuals. The biggest challenge is that everybody comes into our offices with different circumstances, with different preferences, and we have to try to apply the same basic principles, which is how do we help you eat healthier and cut back calories and be more physically active in different situations. And in our current society, when we want to have a quick result with medical weight loss, that often, you know, doesn't happen. So that's one of the reasons why surgeries become quite popular, because people do see a quick result, and that can be very motivating to them as well.
We're talking today with Dr. Maria Collazo Clavel from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, about the country's obesity problem. Maria, let me ask you, we know that the White House had a task force on childhood obesity report recently. We know that Michelle Obama, of course, has really gotten involved in this as the First Lady's campaign about obesity, especially in children. Do you think it's really possible to solve the problem of obesity, especially in the adolescent group or childhood group, within a generation?
Well, I think we're in a situation where we have to focus on it, because the way our population is going to look in the next 20, 30 years might not be very healthy if we continue on this on the current track. But it does involve multiple sectors of our communities and our society in order to tackle this effectively, because it comes down to healthy communities. So you're hoping that your citizens have access to healthy food, to activity, at whatever situation they find themselves in, whether in school, whether it's in their workplace, whether it's in their neighborhood. Because right now, unfortunately, whatever advice we give our patients, the minute they walk out of our doors, most of the environment is working against them. What food, the food that's readily available to them tends to be high in calorie, high in fat, generally unhealthy. The healthier options might be a little pricier. So there are all these subtle obstacles. But if we at least in this generation, we make a significant impact towards that goal, then subsequent generations will be healthier. So I am very hopeful with this initiative. And even if we don't arrive at that specific number, if we make a significant impact, we're going to notice that the benefits will ripple through the whole community.
You know, given the fact that about 70 specific recommendations came out of this White House Task Force on Obesity, you know, Maria, what is the one thing you think is so important we should change right now?
I would involve the food industry. I think the interesting thing is how it's approached, and it's going to be a little bit of a transition. You know, I keep thinking of the example about Coke. Remember when Coke decided to change its formula, and everybody was up in arms as to why did they change the formula, and eventually they brought back the old formula. And I think we are kind of creatures of habit, and in a sense, in our society, we feel that we should be allowed to make a choice, whether it's an unhealthy choice or a healthy choice. But the challenge that the food industry has is how can we help individuals make a healthy choice and not feel like they're sacrificing some aspects of their personal liberties. You know, how can you choose a food that you like, but it's still healthier for you? And I think there's been this whole connotation about what's healthy food, what's unhealthy food, what's financially more affordable food versus not. And I think that's the challenge that the food industry has. But I really think that they have a lot to gain, not only when it comes to the bottom line of finances. If you are able to offer your clients a food that will help them be healthier and they enjoy, and some of those individuals are your employees or the family members of your employees, there are benefits all around. You know, there's always hope, and I have high hopes that that's possible.
We've been talking with Dr. Maria Collazo-Clavel, an associate professor of medicine in the Department of Internal Medicine at the Mayo Clinic Medical School in Rochester, Minnesota. Her specialties include the clinical study of obesity and its complications, as well as weight loss interventions. Thanks so much for joining us on the Recovery Room today.
Wonderful. It was great being here.
Making sense of modern medicine. This is the Recovery Room. I'm Dr. Rick Green. There are few moments in our lives that call for greater compassion and companionship than when a loved one is admitted to the hospital. The opening line of Barack Obama's April memorandum to Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius. Obama asked for rules to be created ensuring that all hospitals that participate in Medicare or Medicaid respect the rights of patients to designate visitors. As Obama's memo explained, the problem is that patients are too often denied access to loved ones who aren't, by law, family members. Although the memo identified childless widows and members of religious orders as potential beneficiaries of these new rules, Obama made particular note of lesbian and gay Americans as being uniquely affected by a status quo that can keep them from their partners in their time of greatest need. High-profile incidents had given a special sense of urgency to the Obama memo, including that of Janice Lanbane and Lisa Pond, in which Ms. Lanbane, along with her four children, were denied access to her partner of 18 years as Ms. Pond died from a brain aneurysm in a Florida hospital. Joining us now to discuss the likely consequences of Obama's memorandum is Kara Levine. Ms. Levine is the director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund and a fellow at the Hastings Center. a nonprofit bioethics research institution located in New York State. Kara Levine, thanks so much for being with us on The Recovery Room.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Kara, let me ask you, President Obama's memo came in the wake of some high-profile cases of patients being denied access to designated loved ones, specifically the Janice Langbaine, Lisa Pond case. But is there any way to tell how widespread the problem is? And certainly not all gay and lesbian partners are being denied visitation rights. Is it more acute in some areas of the country than others?
Well, I think it was an issue in this particular case because someone, and apparently it was the admitting clerk in the emergency room, decided that I don't like the way this couple lives. I don't like the fact that they are living together. They're two women. I'm just going to do my little bit to see that their lives are as miserable as possible. Now, why the physicians on call and the physicians in charge of the case didn't overrule that in the interest of the patient, in the fact that they did see that this partner had the health care, had a legal document saying she was authorized to make health care decisions. So it was kind of an aberration. On the other hand, it happens all over the country. It happens in New York, happens in San Francisco, it happens in South Florida.
Carol, in a recent article in the Hastings Center Bioethics Forum, while you acknowledge the groundbreaking nature of Obama's memo, along with non-discrimination lawmaking that's taking place at the state level, you list two areas of continuing concern regarding patient discrimination. One is the implementation of the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, which we call HIPAA, and two is the need for training and reinforcement at the hospital level. Tell me your concerns with the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act and some of the issues about retraining.
HIPAA is a law that was intended to protect the privacy of patients' personal medical information, mostly through electronic transfers. It was also intended to facilitate the transfer of information between the healthcare facilities, and it's portable. You can take it with you, and it's accountable. So there are a lot of rules about what hospitals and other provider organizations have to do to protect the safety of that information. Unfortunately, when it was introduced with a lot of training that stressed the potential of fines and criminal prosecution for people who violated HIPAA. And it was introduced in a way that made many healthcare providers, direct providers, think if they talked to anyone about the patient's medical condition, they were violating HIPAA. That was never the case, and it's very clear in the HIPAA regulations. Nothing was intended to change the practice of communication between providers and patients and family caregivers. So I think that HIPAA has undergone some revisions and certainly a lot of educations, but I routinely hear from family caregivers that they are told in the hospital, I can't tell you your father's diagnosis because of HIPAA, but I'm taking my father home tomorrow. Do you think it would be good if I knew what to do for him? It's a kind of shield that now exists between professionals and family caregivers, and patients too, to kind of forestall communication and forestall, you know, a lot of discussion. So I think the concern with HIPAA in this context, in the context of the Obama memorandum, is that HIPAA not be used as a way to deny information about the patient's medical condition in situations where it is not a spouse or a parent or some legally identified family member. So I think it can be used that in that way inappropriately, but my concern would be that whatever the regulations are, they very clearly state that HIPAA not be used in this way, that the regular standards for deciding whether information can be shared be used in these situations as well. About the training and retraining and updating, I think that it's one thing for a hospital senior administration to say in its policies and mission statements and all of those good things that are on the website, we do not discriminate on any basis whatsoever. It's another thing for that information to be translated to everyday routine encounters that occur on the hospital floors, in the hospital corridors, in the waiting rooms, in the cafeteria, that every staff member who has information and has an opinion about something, they understand that they are under an obligation, both to their institution and to their discipline, to act in ways that prevent discrimination. That needs to be reinforced over and over again, because old patterns of behavior die very slowly, as we know. So it's not enough just to say the words. It has to be really reinforced. And I think we have a lot of experience with that now in terms of racial discrimination, in terms of gender discrimination. These were, not that long ago, very scary topics for many institutions, and now they're not that scary. Not to say that violations don't occur, but that the ideas are accepted, and I think that this idea will be accepted, but over time.
Today in the Recovery Room, we're talking to Carol Levine. Ms. Levine is the Director of Families and Healthcare Project at the United Health Hospital Fund, and she's a fellow at the Hastings Center in New York. We know that some states, obviously, have put through these non-discrimination clauses.
Yes.
I'm aware in my own state of North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
we just added one. So, you know, again, this is something we can't just depend on the hospitals and the states.
No.
You feel there should be some federal legislation.
Well, I feel it's not legislation per se. It's regulations that govern the standards by which hospitals provide care. So it's not passing a law. It's saying you have agreed to participate, and they're called conditions of participation in Medicare and Medicaid. And for that, you agree to follow certain standard rules of responsibility, of behavior, of practice. There are anti-discrimination laws that have been on the books for a very long time. The hospitals receive federal money through Medicare, Medicaid. There are conditions that come along with getting that money, and one of them is you treat all individuals the same. You do not discriminate on basis of race or religion or sexual orientation or gender or color of hair or whatever you might want to do. So I think this is only, I would see it as a symbolic move and a moral move to say, when this happens, this is wrong. And now you, Secretary Sebelius, give the hospitals some guidance about how to implement this in a way that respects the fact that not every situation can be an open one, but that discrimination is simply not acceptable in this America. I think it will be aided by the fact that the Joint Commission, which does the accreditation for all healthcare organizations, has made this also a new standard, and will be monitoring hospitals and asking them how well they implement this.
Do you think this issue of visitation is generally known by the public to have this concern, this issue that's happening, or is it something that's been sub rosa for a while?
Oh, I think it's been sub rosa, except if it happens to you, and then everyone is quite shocked. I've heard of many cases in which two elderly people, both widower, live together but are not married because of all of the complications of families and so forth, but they share their life in their 80s, and one gets sick, and then the one who is not the wife doesn't get shut out because she's not the wife in a legal sense. And that, you know, that seems wrong too. And it's not because, I mean, do we have to go to the hospital with our marriage certificates and our birth certificates and all of those other things? I mean, I think it can happen in many, many different ways. And the question really is for the healthcare providers to use some common sense and common judgment about, is this a person that the patient would want to have with them? Is this a person who is involved in this person's life, who will be a helpful, soothing, reassuring person to have around? you know, those are management problems. But in terms of the principle of it, there's not a real argument to prevent people in these unusual or non-conventional relationships. And more and more and more of us are in non-conventional relationships, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual or whatever. Families are different now from the way they used to be.
Well, given the president's executive order, and obviously it's going to be effective for Medicare and other issues, what do you think will happen in the short or long term with this process?
I think the regulations that will ultimately be issued will be moderate. They will allow for many exceptions that the hospitals will suggest, you know, well, we will need to control this or that. It will reflect the hospital perspective of wanting to make sure that this is not just an open door for everybody, and that's appropriate. That's fine. So I think it will, if hospitals take it seriously, have a beneficial effect, and they will find that following these sorts of policies will cause them less grief than always fighting with people about, if they can come in or come out, not come in. So I think in the end it will be less revolutionary than it might appear, but ultimately very beneficial. And I think, again, it's mostly a moral statement. It's a symbolic statement, and how hospitals interpret it will be the key.
We've been talking to Carol Levine, Director of the Families and Healthcare Project at the United Hospital Fund. Ms. Levine is also a fellow at the Hastings Center, which is a nonprofit bioethics research institution located in New York State. Carol, I really appreciate your being on the Recovery Room today.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this week. More information about this or upcoming episodes of The Recovery Room, or to listen to previous episodes or subscribe to The Recovery Room podcast, visit recoveryroomshow.org. Thanks to Sam Van Halgren, who produces the show, and to Recovery Room special advisors Drs. Lance Sell and Christy Foley of the Davidson College Medical Humanities Program. The Recovery Room intern is Shelley Blada. Thanks also to Patty Silverman, Anna WDAV, Linda Ray, Kim Klein, and General Manager Ben Rowe. Until next week, I'm Dr. Rick Green. Thanks so much for listening.
The Recovery Room is supported by a grant from the American College of Surgeons Foundation. The Recovery Room is a production of 89.9 WDAV, a service of Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. Find us on the web at recoveryroomshow.org.